Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
The little baby, little Zayden's face, it was beyond recognition due to the injuries, and to see the little bed that he was on and him deceased is an image that I will never, ever be able to forget.
The murder of 10-month-old Zayden Veal Whiting is quite simply one of the most shocking crimes that's ever occurred in Australia. It provided proof, if proof were needed, that methamphetamine addiction was capable of creating a new breed of terror in the suburbs. Zayden's young mother, Casey, discovered an unspeakable horror in her baby's crib after a burglary went horribly wrong in their home in 2012. Narelle Fraser, who worked the case, joins us to talk about the investigation.
In fact, there was three, really. There was Casey, there was the dad, James, who she was separated from, and then there was Matt, who she was with when Zayden was killed. And those three dealt with the whole thing with courage, with admiration. They were... So, is stoic the right word?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I just couldn't believe their maturity for something so terrible to happen. Oh, they were, you know, I put them up on a pedestal. I still do.
So, again, let's go back to when this case first crossed your desk.
Okay, this case first crossed my desk in June, and it wasn't until I started thinking about this more and preparing for today that I thought to myself, my God, this is June 2012. And this was right in the midst of me unravelling big time with my PTSD. And, of course, at the time I didn't know. But in May was when I'd viewed the 1,700 videos, when I'd done the warrant on the pedophile.
1,700 videos, by the way, for listeners who don't remember that bit or haven't heard all of your episodes was child porn, and it was your job to sit down and go through all of those videos and grade them.
And then the next week, so I had the 1,700 child porn videos, and then the next week was the rape committal where I went, you know, missing for 20 minutes, you know, my mind sort of shut down.
You had like an amnesia episode you described it as, didn't you?
Yeah, which I didn't understand what was going on until I was formally diagnosed in September. So that was in the May. And then in the June... this job happened.
Gosh. And wow. So you're under a lot of pressure, aren't you? Like personal pressure.
I am under, but I don't know it, but I'm under enormous pressure.
But surely also if after you've gone missing from the court and they found you having a coffee with yourself over the road.
With my best friend.
Yeah, right. Surely at work they're also, are they keeping a bit of an eye on you too? Are they thinking, is Narelle
okay? I don't
think
so.
Really?
Because again, everyone was busy like that. It wasn't just me.
Wow, okay.
Like the pressure, it was relentless.
Wow.
So, and just for the listeners, when we talk about me going missing, my mind, it was during a rape committal and I was just so stressed that I didn't know at the time, but I had 20 minutes where I lost myself. I didn't know where I was. I found myself over at a coffee shop, and that's when I realised, well, when months later when I was diagnosed, the psych said that it was because my mind had shut down. I'd had an amnesia. What do you call it? I'd had amnesia.
Amnesiac episode or something.
It seems to me like it's, is it a moment where you just literally had to...
My brain stopped.
Yeah, and you had to remove yourself.
I didn't know.
Must have been a protection from your brain, actually.
That's what I think it is. Yeah. It was a protection because the psych actually said to me that you don't know how close you were to hospital.
Wow.
With that 20 minutes. So after, and this is when I'm sort of, I don't know what's going on, but I know something is. And, of course, so then this, I didn't realise, like I said, until really the last couple of weeks preparing for today, and I'm thinking to myself, this is June. This is after the child porn, after the rape committal, and there was just so many things going on, but this is a really major job, and it's funny how you can put something in the back of your mind and try and forget about it.
Because this one's horrific.
This one is bad. And as I said to you before, I'm actually worried about telling it because I'm concerned about you two as well, with Bart as well. This is horrific, but it's just what a drug can do to somebody.
So please, can we just consider this for listeners? A warning, a serious warning about the content of this episode.
It doesn't get much worse than this.
Okay.
So in the June, when this job comes in, is a little 10-month-old baby. His name is Zayden Veal Whiting. So within a month of me doing all this other stuff, I am accompanying a mother and father who were separated to view the body of their 10-month-old son in a sterile hospital room. They had done their best to make it as comfortable as possible. But both Casey and Zayden's father, James, they had to identify their little boy, but not as you would hope, not in the privacy, in private and being alone. Due to his injuries and the fact that we didn't know who was responsible for Zayden's murder, they weren't allowed to hold him, to touch him. I had to be there with them. And he had to be, obviously, after the hospital, when they can't bring him back to life, he has to go for an autopsy. So he had to remain in situ and untouched because of, you know, DNA and evidence and everything. So I felt extremely uncomfortable, obviously, but I had to be there because we didn't know who had murdered Zayden. So everybody is really a person of interest until you can find out who it is. So, look, yes, it could have been Casey, it could have been James, it could have been Matt, it could have been the grandparents. You know, you just have to think outside the square. But the little baby, little Zayden's face, it was beyond recognition due to the injuries. And to see the little bed that he was on and him deceased is an image that I will never, ever be able to forget. And also, not just for me, but the loss and heartache for Casey and Matt and James was also almost too hard to bear. I just can't imagine not being able to hold, to cuddle, to comfort your little 10-month-old baby with what they had been through. As I said before, I had, and still have, so much admiration for them because they were so mature in so many ways. Like, how they handled it, I will never know. But anyway,
I mean, how old were they in reality? These are quite,
I think,
young.
They're only early 20s. Yeah. I think Casey might have been 23, something like that.
Yeah.
But Casey was living with Matt. Her and James had Zayden and another little boy, and they'd separated, and Matt had come onto the scene. And they weren't together, Casey and James, but they co-parented. Like, they were very mature about, you know, with the situation they had.
So they loved their kids and were doing the best for,
yes,
best
and
for them.
They couldn't work out their relationship, obviously, but they both adored their kids and would do, you know, anything for them. But also, so would Matt. You could tell that even though Matt wasn't their father, Matt was a very compassionate. I mean, he came across a bit rough and ready, but he really had the kids' needs and wants was a priority of his, which was lovely. And he never spoke ill of James. He just sort of, and I don't think James, well, from my experience, I didn't see them a lot of tension. Like, sometimes that just doesn't work, does it, the separation. But anyway, so what's happened is Matt, on the 14th of June in 2012, I'm at Bendigo Sex Offence and Child Abuse Unit, and Matt is driving back from Adelaide. He's a truck driver and been on the road for about 8 hours, and he arrives home very early on the 15th of June. The kids are in bed, and Matt and Casey quite willingly tell us that they'd had a smoke of some marijuana. They'd had a few bongs, I think. And they have, for whatever reason, they have a bit of a lover's tiff, and Casey goes to bed. In a huff, I suppose. But Matt stays up and he has a few drinks and he washes his clothes. He's been travelling, washes his clothes. And in the early hours, say about 6:45 or something, Casey's woken up by the young son. He's about 2. I've forgotten what his name is. But he says, "Mummy, the doors are open in the house." So Casey gets up and she finds that the keys to the car are missing. The mobile phone's gone from the bench, and the doors, I think the doors to the car were open, and I think she might have gone out and seen that the car had been rummaged through. So she calls the police and she says there's been a burglary. So she then, while she's waiting for the police for the burg, Matt's in bed and she goes to check on Zayden. And because Zayden hasn't stirred. And anyway, she notices that Zayden's blankets is in a position which is very unusual for him. She knows the way that he sleeps. And she notices that the blankets are up above his nose and the baby monitor has been pulled out of the socket. Anyway, she obviously takes the blankets off and she sees Zayden and she screams because he's got horrific injuries to his face. He's bruised, he's bloodied, and he's very limp. She picks him up and she screams. So Matt comes out and, you know, this breaks my heart, but they thought that he was cold. Well, he was cold, but they went and put him next to the heater to try and warm him up, and they're doing CPR on him to try and bring around anyway. So Casey or Matt, I don't know who it is, rings the police. So the police come around thinking it's a burglary, but it's actually now clearly it's a murder. He'd been struck on his face about 25 times and his head about 15 times with some sort of a blunt instrument. The paramedics arrive and little Zayden is deceased. But, of course, everything changes. The homicide squad are advised. They're en route and they are now in charge of the investigation with assistance from the Bendigo local detectives. In these sort of cases, local knowledge is invaluable because the homies, even though you've got the LEAP system, the locals have got that knowledge of who the local burglars are. So the homies and the CI, they work together really well. One really couldn't do without the other. And by this stage, probably about 9 o'clock, so Zayden's been found at, say, 7. By about 9, the homies are up there and they request me if I can come with one of them and we need to take Matt to the hospital, because now we know that Zayden has passed away. Zayden is now deceased. And, of course, Casey has gone to the hospital and Matt needed to obviously go up there too. We take Matt up to the hospital. But there were so many difficult things with this job because not only, I mean, a little baby being bashed is horrendous, but we need to keep Casey and Matt separated because at this point we don't know of their involvement, if they're involved, if any. And our concern is that obviously if they are together without us, they might, if they have done something, they might collaborate, they might work out some sort of an alibi.
This reminds me of that, like something, again, that I never understood about policing that I first saw in the Jill Maher documentary about this moment where you're either sitting with terrible perpetrators who've done something unforgivable, or you're sitting with parents who have had the most unforgivable thing done to them and you don't know which is which.
No.
I mean, that to me is how you then relate to those people. I can't imagine. I can't imagine how you relate to them, let alone professionally.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because what they could be is just devastated parents, or they could have been the ones that have bashed this little boy beyond recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're
right. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that I would have the wherewithal to be able to conduct my job without, I don't think I could imagine that they could be involved, and so I would be compromising cases all over the shop because, you know, I couldn't be, I don't think I could be professional in that situation.
It's funny, I know exactly what you mean, but you have to be, because they could be the perpetrator, but they could just be two devastated parents. Mm. It's difficult. Well, it's not difficult. I don't know what it is. But
well, you've got to just go through the processes. I guess the processes are very clear, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you've just got to push the emotion to the side and go through the processes.
Yeah. Because I know when Matt was in the car with us going up to the hospital, he just couldn't believe that Zayden was deceased.
Mm.
But I kept thinking to myself, is he telling the truth? It was in the back of my mind, has he done this? That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got to think of that, but you've still got to be able to put it aside. I think it's awful for us, for the police.
Yes.
But I think, oh, my God, like what about the parents and the family, the grandparents, the friends, you know. Anyway, so we have to separate, search and secure. That's what you do with witnesses, with suspects, mm-hmm. with everyone. You separate, search and secure. Okay. So outside hospital, we've got three families, James family, Matt's family, Casey's family, and they are so distressed, like it's unimaginable. But remember that Matt, they want to comfort one another.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They want to be, you want to be together, but in the worst moment of your life.
Cruel, sort of, in a way that I remember I almost had to ask, not almost, I had to ask permission from the homies, look, do you mind if they just give one another a cuddle? Because I don't want to muck up the investigation. Anyway, so the bottom line is they said, look, stay with them, but, you know, like fancy, God. It's just an impossible situation. So then we have to work out who's going to identify Zayden. And the families all agree that it's going to be Casey and James, the father. So also Casey and James are separated, but they were just so adult and so understanding of the whole situation, as I said, including Matt. Their behaviour, I'd have to say, was exemplary, even the families. So I stayed with them, and I remember I held Casey's hand and I took her and James followed and I took them into the room where little Zayden was, and I tried to give them as much I turned around so that I didn't have to, well, number one, look at little Zayden, but I couldn't leave them. Like, it was, yes, it was.
So they can't have that moment in privacy. They've got to have a police person with them.
No. And a number of suspects were identified pretty quickly. That's where the locals just have such really good knowledge of, you know, locals in the area that this is the sort of thing they do. So the police, with the homies, the locals do quite a number of warrants over the next couple of days. But to add to the list of suspects for the burglaries, there's also two escapees from the local psychiatric hospital.
Oh, wow.
One of which had left teddy bears and little candles outside a house at a previous, he was besotted with babies. So that was something else to add to the who else it could be. Like, you know, you've got to cast your net very wide. One of the suspects was a guy called Harley Hicks. He lived around the corner. He was a local ice addict doing small-time dealing, done armed robberies. He was only a kid, but he'd had a pretty bad life. So the police do a number of warrants, but they're looking for stuff for the Bergs, you know, for the house keys and all that sort of stuff. They find at Hicks' house, Harley Hicks' house, they find a set-top box in his house, which had been stolen from a house opposite where Casey and Matt lived the previous night.
Wow.
Which puts him in the area.
And in someone else's house.
Yeah. And Hicks was certainly a person of interest for the burglaries. However, Hicks isn't at home. He has fled to Gisborne. He was supposed to go the day after, but for whatever reason, he's gone the 15th. He was supposed to go the 16th, something to do with his girlfriend's parents or something like that. But he's gone the day before he was supposed to, a little tick. So the police certainly had him as a person of interest for the Bergs because he was a known burglar, stolen goods, all that sort of stuff. So the police set about finding him. Hicks and his girlfriend Martina had gone to Gisborne, and we now know that Hicks was checking the internet for news of the burglaries and the murder of Zayden. We also know that he'd cut up his tracksuit by the time he'd gone to Gisborne and he'd discarded it. Martina told Hicks that police were looking for him, so he fled. That night he slept grass of the local football oval. The police knew that Hicks was really close to his dad, so they watched his dad, and his dad picked him up the following day, and the police actually intercepted him on the highway to Bendigo. And they got Hicks and they interviewed him for the burglaries. So I've got to stress here that he's only a suspect for the burglaries, okay? But police are starting to add two and two together. There's certainly enough to arrest him, but they've got his interest. He has got their interest. He was interviewed for the burglaries, and the police then did a warrant on his house. This led to, it's another evidence warrant, a Section 465 evidence warrant, looking for more stuff from the burglaries. But what they find is Matt's wallet.
Oh, wow.
So that puts him at the house.
Wow.
They also find a whole lot of other things that had been taken from other burglaries. So things were starting to get more serious. So they interview him for the burgs and he suddenly admits, I did them all, or not all, you know, he goes through, I did this, this and this. So what happens then is the process goes along very quickly. I think he gets remanded in custody and he gets 12 months. So he's inside for the burgs.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Have I still got you?
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. Right. Because, but no, you always had me. But but I get this is an intriguing like perspective that I haven't heard before. That you're able to get him on one series of crimes and then have him isolated in one place for the rest of the investigation into the
but
baby.
But he's certainly not. Well, I think over the next day or two, he then becomes a suspect for the murder, but he is inside for the burglaries. Great. He hasn't been asked about the murders. No, nothing like that. It's just for the burgs.
Right.
But the investigation into the murder continues, and by now, Hicks is starting to look pretty interesting.
Mm.
I'd probably put him in a person of interest.
Not a suspect yet, even though you can place him in the home on the night that the baby was murdered.
But we now, I suppose, we now have to prove, what from what you're saying, he's saying he was in there for the burgs, but he didn't murder the baby, right? So,
no. Okay, but you don't have a murder weapon yet?
No.
No.
No. Okay. Okay, so the investigation continues, but what happens is an undercover policeman goes and sits in the cells with him.
Ah.
And he revealed information to the undercover policeman that only the killer would know. Mm. I don't know what that information was, but I believe that it was pretty strong. So then the detective with the homies, Tony Harwood, he's going over all the information regarding the murder, and the crime scene people believe it's some sort of a blunt instrument. Well, during one of the warrants at the house, they've found a baton.
At his house, at Hicks's house.
At Hicks's house. Mm-hmm. They take it, but they don't know the relevance, but it's something that they think, look, we'll take. Anyway, the bottom line is Tony going through everything, he thinks, I might get that baton tested. Well, Zayden's DNA is found on the baton.
God.
The baton is a homemade sort of wooden baton and it's got sort of nails and tape around the bottom. So they find Zayden's DNA, but they also find Hicks' DNA on the baton. They also find at the house some bike boots at his home, which had been stolen from a house close by to Zayden's house the night of Zayden's murder. And this all sounds very simple, but it took a long time. But a footprint at the back of Zayden's house on a couch to jump over the fence matches that boot, the bike boot that he has stolen. Mm. So he's charged with the murder, September 2012. And he pleads not guilty. He then says it was the twin brother.
His twin brother.
That did the burg and the murder.
Oh, my God. Oh. He put in his own twin brother.
Yeah. Now, he has an identical twin brother.
Uh-huh.
And identical twins have identical DNA.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. So what sort of a man or what sort of a monster would ever put in your brother as the murderer? But he also, Hicks also put in another furphy to say that on the night of the burgs that he had this friend that he put in and said that his mate was doing the burgs with him and he left him a couple of times and he didn't know what he did. So that young man, young boy, was arrested and interviewed. Mm. He had to be, but he had a watertight alibi, the young bloke that he said it was, but so did his brother.
I was actually going to give him sort of the benefit of the doubt with the brother thing and say, was he thinking that that a jury could never not have reasonable doubt about the DNA and stuff like that, that maybe neither of them could ever be convicted of the crime? But I think I saw that in a movie once and that's where I'm getting that from.
Yeah.
Impossible? Not real?
Oh.
I guess so. There's all the other evidence, though, that stands against Harley Hicks but not against his brother. There's the stolen property in his home.
Yeah, but also his brother, his twin brother, he doesn't live at the house where Harley Hicks lives.
Yeah.
Were they close or not close?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about the twin brother. But I just couldn't get it out of my head that you would actually put your twin brother in for a murder.
No, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty.
And then to also put a friend in, it's like, yeah, really, you just. Yeah.
And in the end, I think it was the father that actually had that gave a watertight alibi for the twin brother, so it could only have been Harley. Hicks had a history of the jury weren't able to be told the extent of Hicks' drug habit, for how long he'd been a drug user, because they were saying that it was prejudicial to hear this, which it would be, to a jury, and that it could be seen as being unfair to the accused. So it wasn't able to be led.
Just, I always wonder, though, do people... That, I reckon juries are smarter than that.
Yeah.
Like, I know it's how the law works, but I think, you know, well, this guy's been charged with killing a baby. I mean, did they think that the drug use aspect would maybe get him off the hook or...?
I think that if once I knew that he was a heavy ice user, it would probably seal the deal for me.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very prejudicial.
Yeah.
But Hicks had a history of years. Like, he was only, oh, I don't know, 18. So he was very young.
Mm.
But he had a history of years of repeated drug use, cannabis, heroin, ecstasy, alcohol and ice. So,
God. And all this was obviously revealed after he was found guilty and sentenced.
Yep.
That became public knowledge.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. And the jury couldn't be told about his priors either, which were escalating. But it was amazing that the murder and the series of burglaries and thefts were committed 2 months after Hicks was placed on a community corrections order for an armed robbery.
Mm.
So he's out on a community corrections order for the armed robbery and he murders little Zayden.
And as you say, though, it is showing an escalation, isn't it? He's gone from burglary to armed robbery, so violence is...
To murder.
To murder, yeah.
And that's where I guess the public gets so riled up.
They're
like, well, what the hell is this happening? I'm not saying I think community correction orders have their place and are probably very beneficial to certain people, but I guess that's why the public just can't, maybe doesn't have faith in how these things work.
Yeah, but it's... It's a double-edged sword. If the public do know, well, you'd think it's him.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, true. You know, so yeah, that's it. You can't, and that is not giving someone the presumption of innocence in a fair trial.
Yeah. And when you think about it, like to go inside for murder, you can get 25 years.
Yeah.
So I think...
Got to get it right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
After the break, Narelle shares her recollections of Harley Hicks's trial. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Narelle talks about the emotional trauma inflicted on everyone involved in this case. But first, Harley Hicks's trial.
I thought it was interesting that in the doc, apparently Hicks was just a real smart ass.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he winked at Tony Harwood, the informant.
Oh.
He snored in the doc. His family were harassing the witnesses like Casey.
That's
and all
horrific.
The, yeah, it is, as if they haven't got enough on
that
their
is
plate.
Horrific.
His mother was taking photos of him in the dock and putting it on Facebook.
I saw that the judge said that almost wrecked the trial, that she was reckless in putting it on Facebook.
Like, even from the forgetting the legal point, what about how could you take a photo of your son in the dock and think... And, like, it's like I'm proud of my son in the dock. He's being tried for murder.
You've got to question the how people's minds work, don't you?
Never would I make excuses ever for Harley Hicks. But you think if that's the sort of upbringing he has had, what does society expect of him? Like, he's never been like, he's an adult, of course he is, and he's okay enough to be able to deal in drugs and the money and all that sort of stuff and do burgs and be sneaky.
I assumed in my rudimentary knowledge of this case that once Harley Hicks cleaned up in prison, and I'm assuming he cleaned up in prison, although I know that drugs are available in prison, that he was mortified by what had happened. I had no idea that he was sitting in court.
I think I had the same
being obnoxious and
kind of idea.
Yeah, I had no idea of that part of it. That is horrific.
Yeah, he never ever admitted it, I don't believe. And he was arrogant, he was smart, he was rude, but it didn't get past the jury. I mean, I think the jury saw him, but fancy winking at the police.
I can't believe any of it.
Like, that just shows.
And it shows the fact that you're in that court. It's a murder trial. You'd be scared, I think. You'd be horrified.
But
I don't
we're
know, most
thinking
people...
about it from
yes.
a like he was to actually do what he did. Apparently, he's never given a reason for it. He's never given a motive. And apparently what the homies deducted was that he had done it because he wanted to quieten the baby. He didn't want the baby to wake up.
Right,
that is the only reason they can come up with as to why he did it. So it was like, what if you wanted to do that, why wouldn't you just take the monitor? Why wouldn't you just pull the monitor? Like, why would you
why
have
wouldn't
to
you just get out?
I
of
think
the
that's
house.
The question. You're like, why? Why would you?
But if you
why
know,
is it not enough to just burgle someone's house?
As an ICE user, I mean, the question of why is just sort of almost. Inappropriate.
Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to it.
I know
there,
that he said in his first police interview that he was off his nana. That was a quote from him in his interview about that night. He never admitted that he had killed Zayden, but he said, I was off me nana.
Yeah. I think he'd done quite a few burgs that night.
Yeah. Do you know if he continued about his business on that night after he had killed Zayden?
I think he went back home and his girlfriend said that he came home and then he went back out. So I think he was probably, I'm assuming here, that he did a couple of burgs, he'd drop the stuff off at home and then he'd go out and, you know, maybe score some drugs and then do another couple. But he was fairly prolific on that night. To hide the murder weapon.
Yeah, and the clothes. Tear up his clothes. And...
Yeah.
So I was going to ask, this would be a kind of silly question, but in his drug-addled psychotic state or whatever it was, I was like, would he have known what he was doing? But then when you say what he did to cover up, then of course he would have known what he was doing.
I always thought he didn't know what he did, and then once he cleaned up, he must have just felt horrible. But no.
Look, I don't understand. I just know the experience that I've had with people on ICE is that they have a strength that I've never – it's just like eight times their normal strength. They just have – something happens and I don't know if they actually do know what they're doing. I have no idea, but they must, because why is he hiding the weapon behind – because he had the baton hidden behind a picture frame. So he must have known, you know, and the fact that he fled – the day before he was supposed to, he's left Bendigo and he's looking up. Now, that's another thing too, you know, at Martina or Melina, what her name is, at her parents' house, he's on the internet looking up the murder of Zayden and the burglary. So I don't quite understand what happens with ICE.
No, but he's clearly completely conscious of what he's done.
I wanted to go back to, I think he was given
32 years.
Okay, 32 years.
Well, he's been given a life sentence, yes, with a non-parole period of 32 years.
To be in there for 33 years, I've been into jail to interview people and I don't understand why anybody would ever want to go and live, say, at Pentridge or, you know, how they make them out to be these residential places. They give me the creeps. 5 minutes in there, it's an awful place to be. All I remember about that job is just the esteem, I suppose, that I hold Casey and Matt and James in, and the family for that matter. Like, it was just horrendous. But I'll never forget his little face ever. It was like a pumpkin.
Oh my God.
And like, he's only 10 months old. He'd been beaten 25 times. That's on his face and then his head. You know, you think, how could anybody, ICE addict or not, how could you do that?
It's just, I don't know. And to then cover it up, like pull the blanket up over, you know.
Yeah.
So actually that does show in you.
I was just going to say, you can't say he didn't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. So he's going to be in jail for a very long time. And I guess it's not comfort to the family, but at least they've got justice, I guess, in a way.
I can tell you that work is underway on a memorial playground and garden in Eagle Hawk.
Started this year, I think.
Casey has been very...
Yeah, that's beautiful.
I don't think her and Matt are together now, but Casey, like, there's T-shirts you can get and she's been very outspoken. Like, she's quite a trailblazer, I suppose, in a lot of ways, isn't she? Like, that is admirable.
Oh, for such a, again, such a young woman.
Yeah.
But they were brave, so brave, and she in particular was so brave and courageous. It, as I said, I have nothing but admiration for them.
I read just before she was quoted saying, you know, her life has obviously been completely changed. She has to deal with a new existence, and it has ruined, as she did say, it had ruined relationships. So possibly she and Matt didn't survive that.
I don't know
how many, could you?
Yeah, there wouldn't be too many that could.
And Jane, you know, how is James going and the little boy? Yep. And it's just, she does sound like an incredible young woman.
Whilst I don't have any doubt that they were all Casey and Matt and James and that they were well provided for, they weren't blessed with money. Mm-hmm. They weren't blessed with wealth or privilege. But I think what they've displayed is that they've obviously been brought up with something that money can't buy, and that is respect, responsibility, and providing a warm and loving home. And whilst the trial is over, their pain isn't. I have nothing but admiration for them. Go Casey, hey?
If you'd like to support Zayden's family, you can go to the Zayden's Army Facebook page. That's Zayden with a Y.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars, and to follow us on Facebook.